stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing to talk about how one can discover one's undercover qualities. Those qualities which belong to us but which we have had to hide even from ourselves, and how you can use your family pie to discover what you may have hidden about yourself from yourself. I also talk a little bit about why change can be so difficult and what it means when you can't make a change you really want to. Also, I'm playing an interview I did with graduating conservatory student Ghaffey Akbar, who came from Malaysia and who may very well be a star in the American theater. So, hang on. Here come the show. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering who you really are. Perhaps you think it's odd or maybe even wrong for me to say that you don't know who you really are. But as my experience as a psychotherapist for many, 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 many years suggests, there are qualities that many of us, most of us, maybe even all of us, are hiding from ourselves. Qualities which we have naturally, but which we learned early in life did not fit with the idea our family had of either who we were or who we needed to be. And so we learned, and all children can do this, to first to pretend that we weren't that, whatever that was, and then the pretense got so good that we forgot we were that, whatever that was, and essentially hid that, not only from others, but from ourselves. The ironic thing is that in my practice, when people come to me and they present whatever problem it is, quite often, exactly the quality that they need, want, come to me searching for, is already there. But it is what I call undercover, which is to say they learned early on to hide it. And they got so good at it that they forgot they had it. So, for example, the young woman who came in because she was completely burned out, workaholic, work, 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 work. And, of course, now she was so tired, so exhausted, that she was beginning to have physical symptoms and the depression that can accompany that. Well, the capacity to be what she derisively called a couch potato was actually undercover in her. And if you've been listening to the last few shows, I've been talking about the family pie. And in her family pie, her brother got assigned the dreaded couch potato quality. And she got assigned the hardworking quality. And so he loafed, was lazy, could not hold a job, was dependent and irresponsible. And she was, of course, all the opposite. Hardworking, thrifty, hyper-responsible, take care of everybody except herself. These qualities both existed in the system. You could see it in the pie. But the brother got assigned the one and the sister got assigned the other. And the one that the sister got assigned, although it looked like the better choice, right? In the end, wound up costing her terrifically. And what she needed was to get back what's already in the system. Because I believe that if it's in the system, it's in you. It's already in the system. We could see it in the brother. She needed his ability to coast a little bit, not to work so hard, to let some things go, not to take care of everybody. And, of course, he needed all the qualities that she had. But she was the one who came into therapy, so she was the one that that worked on uncovering her ability, which was already there, to lighten up, not to work quite so hard, not to take on everybody, not to fix people who were not really her responsibility to fix. So, as you've been listening to me describe this situation with this particular young woman and how the very quality that she needed in order actually to save her life, because her health was beginning to suffer from this over-attachment to working and under-attachment to play, to rest, etc. So as you've been listening, can you think of something you think you wish you had? Are you working too hard? Are you unable to rest, take a vacation, say no? Or are you like the brother, unable to work, unable to care for yourself, continually feeling berated and embarrassed by the fact that you can't get it together? Or maybe these qualities are not at all what is of interest to you or importance to you. Maybe you are shy and need to be a little more assertive. Or maybe you're just out there all the time, you know, life of the party, everybody's, you know, best friend. Maybe you need to be a little bit more self-contained. I don't know if you've been listening. I don't know whether you've done your family pie. But if you have, look to see if that other quality is in the system. Because if it is, it's in you as well. The other thing I like to talk about in my shows is change. My book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, is all about why, as I say in the title, we can't make the changes we want to make when we want to make them. We live in a culture that says that if you want it, you just have to want it enough and you can do it. If at first you don't succeed, try again. And then if you don't succeed, try again. And then if you don't, well, you get it, right? In fact, I believe if you have tried, and tried, and you still haven't been able to make the change you want to make, that there's a very good reason. You're not, as you may be calling yourself, lazy or crazy or self-destructive or sabotaging. No, I don't believe human beings are self-destructive. I believe we are self-protective. And if there's a change you want to make, if there's a quality you want to develop, and you haven't been able to do it, well then, there's a very good reason. And perhaps just for a moment, you could stop thinking about how badly you want to be different and just wonder what the good reason you might have for not being different might be. You know, the other thing I do in my show is I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. The reason I do that is because in order to make a living or a life with an art in our culture, it has to be who you really are. Because we are not a culture that encourages arts. I'm fond of saying, you know, that parents are delighted if their child sings or dances or makes them laugh or draws. But very soon they want to know, what are you going to do for a living? You know, it's not so cute when kids say they want to be an actor or a writer or a painter. And so anyone who sticks it out does so because they can't help it. It's who they really are. When I started doing these interviews, I expected to find people saying, well, I wanted to do this, and so I did. What I found instead was quite often people found it by accident. It seemed to find them. And that's how it is with the interview I'm playing today, with Ghafe Akbar. If you were listening last week and heard my interview with Jennifer Logue, you heard Jennifer talk about Ghafe and say that in her mind he's already a star. Just graduating last June from the Oslo Conservatory program there. And by the way, this interview, I did this interview as he was graduating, so you'll hear him talk about how scary it is to go from training to the real world. Ghafe is an amazing actor. And he didn't actually choose this until after it chose him. So you'll hear how what he thought was a kind of fun hobby took off and how he finally chose to leave engineering school where he had a scholarship to pursue what he realized was his passion, acting. This is a really interesting story. And Ghafe is not only a terrific actor, but a very, very thoughtful young man. And so, without saying any more about it here, Ghafe Akbar. So I'm here in an unused dressing room in the Oslo Theater with Ghafe Akbar. And he is about to graduate from the conservatory.
Correct, yep.
Okay, and it's a two-year program.
Three-year program.
It's a three-year program. Mm-hmm. I do this interview series for my radio show.
Okay.
It's called Anatomy of an Artist. Mm-hmm. And I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
And this is something that you intend to do.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes, yes.
Absolutely.
Good. So, I always ask the same question.
Okay.
And that is, how did it find you? How did it capture you? How did you find it? How did it happen?
Okay. I've always watched plays growing up. My sister would always take me to see shows, be it, you know, English plays or other, you know, Malay language plays or dance, but, you know.
Where did you grow up?
In Malaysia.
Aha.
Yeah, born and raised.
Born and raised?
Yeah.
And you didn't learn to speak English when you moved here?
No, I grew up speaking English.
Because?
Because it was taught. And everybody speaks English. It's a Commonwealth country, so...
I see, so everybody...
So everybody spoke English, yeah.
So you have an older sister who is in theater?
I do. She's not. She's a teacher. She's an English teacher.
Ah.
And throughout her life, she, you know, would take me to see a lot of shows. Part of her, probably her assignment at college, but I would just go with her as a company. And so, you know, theater and drama and performing arts was never really quite foreign. Mm-hmm. And in high school, me and a few friends decided to kind of put together some plays, and we wrote some plays. You know, they were probably bad in retrospect, but but you know, we had the passion. You know, we had the realization that we wanted perhaps to pursue this as a hobby, or you know, not knowing it was going to be a career. But so we had like this set of four plays, and then we went up to a theater company in Kuala Lumpur, where I grew up, and said, you know, we have these four plays. Do you mind if we use your space for a weekend? And all the proceeds and the money and the profit from tickets, you can take it, because we just needed a platform to perform and get an audience in. And then and they agreed, and we got into the theater for a weekend and had a great time, had a great audience come in. And it so happened that one day, one of the performance, a director who was casting for her show came to see the show and then called me in for an audition. And a week later, I got a job. So it was technically my first theater job, and it was...
How old were you?
18.
18?
Yeah.
And you had no preconceived notion that this would be your career?
No, it was something that I knew I liked to do and I was involved with in high school, but no, like I didn't know that this is what I was going to do.
Did you know that, was there something else you thought you might do, or did you
in
just
fact,
have no...
I was actually about to go into engineering school.
Oh, yeah.
I got accepted to a big university in Malaysia and was pursuing, and actually ended up spending 3 years in an engineering program. Until I realized, at the same time while I was in engineering school, I was also dabbling in theater and getting a lot of professional jobs, and you know, started doing TV and movie, and basically did you know quite well for myself.
Yes. So this happened to you.
Yes.
In a way.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you were playing.
Yeah.
And it took you seriously.
Yeah. And I guess I just got lucky. I've always considered myself to be very lucky.
Did any of the other kids that... You did those plays with, did they go into theater?
No.
No, just
actually,
you.
Yeah. There were about four or five of us. Most of them went into either law or some sort of a communication program.
So this whole thing was like a launch pad for you.
Without me knowing it, yes.
Yeah.
And it was bit by bit. It didn't, you know, catch me off guard or like...
You didn't say, here I am.
It
no.
was just like, you know, little bites, like, oh, here's another one, oh, here's another one.
And then one day you looked at it and you said, oh.
Yeah, you know, 3 years into engineering school, you know, I realized that I was having a lot more fun in class drawing, you know, like chemistry sets. You know, sometimes you do experiments, you have to, like, draw the lab report and all the stuff. And I had more fun drawing and coloring those things. And I'm like, maybe you should be in the arts. So... Yeah, and then so I left engineering school, and...
And how did your family feel about that? I'm just curious.
Oh, they were not very happy, no. As they should be. I mean, you know, I had myself a good program, and I got a scholarship to study. So, you know, to let that go, they were a little reluctant about it, but...
You must have felt very strongly then.
I did. You know, it was a very hard time to figure that out, to realize...
Yes.
After so long, knowing what I actually wanted to do. It was a big realization, but something I wasn't fully prepared to embrace. But
for a minute, because I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because this is what I hear. I hear that underlying for much of your life was this thread about theater, about performing, mm-hmm. about acting, about communication in that way, right?
Yeah.
But there was an overlay of the guy you thought you needed to be, the engineer, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so these two things are running parallel to each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the universe starts giving you an opportunity mm-hmm. to do this other thing, right?
Absolutely.
And at some point, you become aware of the significance of that to you. That what seemed to be an underground thing is actually really powerful.
Yeah.
Is that
absolutely? And I think that. And you're right. I mean, I don't think I ever had a moment where I chose theater. I think it chose me before I even knew.
And then you looked around and said, oh, okay.
Yeah, and everything was already there for me, and then I felt like it would be a wrong move or a stupid move to not embrace it.
Okay, but when you say that as though it were an easy thing to do, and it's quite clear that it was not.
No, not at all.
No.
I mean, and it was hard, you know, like I actually waited for a while before I actually had the guts to tell my parents.
I'm sure.
And my sister, again, was a big help. Like, I actually told her first, and, you know, she convinced me to tell my parents. And,
Did she think it was a terrible thing?
She didn't. She was very supportive. She said, it's good that you know it. It's good that you know what's right and what's wrong, what you want and what you don't want to do.
Good for her.
And not a lot of people know that.
No, not only don't a lot of people know that, but not a lot of people know that that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
You know, good, God bless her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, And I think I got it easy. I mean, I think that I had an option to leave. It wasn't like, oh, I'm done with engineering. I don't know what else to do. But I had a place to go. Yeah,
right, right.
I had a passion. I knew what I wanted to do, and I was adamant about it.
And you were really lucky in your sister, because so many people believe that there's a right way to be and that there isn't a you in there that you should be. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it's the truth of, you just got to be true to yourself.
Yeah, well, that's easy to say, and not a lot of people get an opportunity to do it. But one of the reasons that I interview actors and musicians and people who make their living with their creativity is because people who do that are people who know who they are and have followed who they are.
Yeah.
Because you can't do that in this culture unless you have to.
Yeah. And, you know, to look at a bigger picture, you can't be an artist or create art if you don't know who you are as a person.
No, that's exactly right. That's right. And you have to often, not everybody, but lots of the people who do this, have to confront a resistance in order to get there.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's kind of a cliche if I mention this, but you just kind of, you know, most good artists that I've met, and I think that they have lived through something, you know, they've fought to be where they are right now, and I think that what makes artists strong and passionate and diligent at their craft.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if you get it easy and everything falls in your lap, then...
Actually, I've heard some stories that sort of contradict that.
I don't doubt that. But
no, it's true. And there are some people here for whom it was very easy.
Yeah, that's great.
And
but
they love it, and they're committed to it, and they were just lucky.
No, but I think the artist who suffered tells a better story.
Yes, I think so. Well, actually, in a way, that's an important thing. And the thing I think it's important to tell people that they don't have to suffer for their art.
You're right.
I don't mean that a lot of people don't. I mean, I think a lot of people do. I think it is in a way a cliche, and a cliche is a cliche because so many people experience it. But I think some people think that they don't deserve it because they didn't suffer for it.
Yeah.
And that's not. I just don't believe that that's true.
But I suppose however works for you, whatever makes you.
That's right.
The
however
better,
you got there.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you clearly did, though. You did.
I did,
You did. I
had my fair share.
I know you did. I know. Okay, so you're... how old are you when you did this? When you quit school?
18, 19, 20. About 21.
About 21.
Yeah.
Alrighty. And then what did you do?
And I kind of hung around a little bit, and I was still working. I was doing... I was attached... At that point, I got attached to a theater company in Kuala Lumpur. So I was working, doing a lot of work with them and got exposed to a lot of ways of working. I did a lot of work in political satire, a lot of work in more traditional art forms with, you know, shadow puppets. So it was kind of a great experience for me to have to not really have a formal training, but just experience everything that was available for me. So it was... soon after that, I realized that I needed to go back to school and that I needed to have a proper training instead of just trying to pick everything up from up in the air. And again, you know, as luck would have it, I was doing a show one summer, and the chairman of the theater department at Western Michigan University was on vacation in Malaysia and happened to come see a show that I was doing.
Yeah, there's no luck in here. Oh my
gosh,
great!
And so he saw the show, and he asked to have dinner together, and I did, and we had a great time and got to know each other. And he said, you know, if you want to come study at Western Michigan University to do your bachelor's degree, you'll have a spot.
Holy cow!
Yeah, and I was like, okay. So I, you know, went home and thought about it, and
were you still living at home?
I was still living at home. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I decided to do it. And
why not?
Yeah, but then I knew, you know, it was going to cost a lot of money.
Yes.
And
yes.
You know, all this, another hurdle to go through. So it wasn't until 2 years after that I finally, in 2004, that I finally got secured the scholarship to come to the U.S. to study. It was essentially me, you know, knocking on doors, sending out letters, applying for scholarships, asking around, and saving money. You know.
You worked for it.
I did, and you know, and every single letter came back, you know, rejections after rejections, and I actually, the final interview that I went to, I said, if this doesn't happen, you know, I've worked for 2 years to try to make this happen. If it doesn't happen, then it's just not meant to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember had a meeting with this guy, with the CEO of the company, and then and he said, basically, he said he was going to give me the money. And then it didn't really hit me, and it was like a 15-minute meeting, and he was, you know, like asking me all these questions and being really hard on me. And then it wasn't until I got in the elevator and was on my way down, and I was with my friend, and the security guy was taking us downstairs back to the lobby. And then it just hit me, and I just started crying.
Yeah, that you got it.
And I was just like, oh my God, like my life is changing.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that.
It's interesting. Your story is really interesting because it is a very funny combination of struggle and luck.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and I want to tell you, it's a little unusual. There's either the struggle story,
yeah,
or there's the luck story.
Yeah.
But you seem to have equal parts.
You know, it's like maybe life hands me something, and then just when I try to grab it,
it
just pulls
away
a little bit.
Right. It says work for it.
Yeah.
Right. And you do.
Yeah.
You do. So it's so clearly. Well, it's great. It hangs the carrot.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
And then it makes you run after it. Right. That's great.
And then at some point, just when you can't. You know, just when
you just think you're not going to be able to run anymore.
You can't take it, you can't get it, then that's when it says, oh, here you go.
Here you go.
And that's what I strongly believe, that, you know, you got to work hard for whatever you earn in life, you deserve it. Either in a way that, you know, what you give to the universe, what you give to other people, it all comes back to you. That's mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful way to think. Mm. So, okay, so now you go to school.
Yes.
4 years?
When I was doing the 2 years I was waiting, I took some college credits so that in the event that I actually get to go, I just get to transfer them.
Yeah.
So I spent 3 years in undergrad at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And
A little different than Malaysia.
A little colder.
I was just going to say, oh my God, but you didn't have clothes on.
I shopped a lot. And I had such a great time, you know, and I thought I was going to be horribly homesick because I'm the baby in the family. I'm the last of five. And I didn't. I mean, I did maybe for the first couple of weeks, and I didn't know anybody. And, you know, the theater department can, you know, they tend to be a little cliquey, small group.
And you're not an American.
And I'm not an American. Mm-hmm. But they completely embraced me. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just like...
It was right.
It was, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have put it better, yeah. And the first show I did, it was a three-person play, and I played a 40-year-old Indian man, which was funny, because I was walking down the hallway during, like, the first couple of days of school, and then one of the professors saw me, and it's like, do you go here? I'm like, yeah, this is my third day. He's like, oh. And then he brought me to introduce me to this other student who was directing the show, and then it was like, oh my God, they've been looking for this Indian-looking guy,
right.
You know, like ethnic-looking
yet
guy.
Yet again.
And then I didn't even have it. It just came to me.
Yeah. Oh, yet again.
Yeah.
It's really an interesting story.
And again, I had to work hard for it because the part is written in Hindi, so I don't speak a word of Hindi.
It's actually literally written in Hindi.
Yes, it's an Israel Horovitz play.
Oh, my God.
Al Pacino was in the original production. But, yeah, so I had to literally learn phonetically and by sound how to speak Hindi.
Right.
Not that anybody knew, but I was like, I'm not going to fake it.
No.
So,
of course not, because that's what you do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Let me work at it.
Yeah. So and then it just snowballed, you know. Like, I did really well, and everybody, you know, had a great time. Would want to cast me, and I worked hard, loved it, made a lot of good friends. We had a lot of good memories. And then I didn't have enough, of course. So I graduated undergrad. I said I need to go to a graduate school. Like, I feel like I have a training, but now I need to take everything that I've learned and start from A again, which is what, you know, I came here for. And because the first year of training here at the Oslo is just forget everything you've learned. Let's learn about you. So learn about you as a tool for yourself as an actor. So
really?
Yeah.
And how do they do that?
Well, the three classes we take in acting, voice, and movement, you find a neutral voice. You eliminate all the habitual patterns you have, all the bad habits you developed as an actor over the years. They'll identify it and then says, we'll make it neutral, and then you can build around it. Take back everything you've learned. Mm-hmm. Movement, you know, you learn a good posture. I'm horrible posture right now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you learn the neutral posture. Learn how to, so that you know yourself as a human being and as a tool for all these characters you'd be playing. So if you don't know your posture, if you don't know a proper posture, how can you achieve any other posture? And in acting, in the power of observation and neutrality, and the big lesson is observing things so that everything becomes an inspiration. instead of you having to look for it. So, you know, so your mind is open, your heart is open to embrace anything that can happen on stage. So
you loved it.
Oh my gosh.
I know, it's written
now
all over you.
Now that I'm 30, I want to go back.
I know, it's written all over you.
Yeah, but you know, like, but now that it's almost over, I'm looking forward to...
Yes, what?
Making it work.
Do you have plans?
Yeah, we go up to New York in a few days, at least Saturday, for a showcase where we meet casting directors and agents and do a little showcase for them. And hopefully get some interest or somebody mm-hmm. interested in representing me.
Right.
If nothing happens in New York, I think I'm going to move to Chicago.
Because?
A lot of friends I have from Michigan is now live in Chicago. And a lot of the guest artists that are here this year at the Oslo are also from Chicago. And Chicago's been this big, booming theater town, and a lot of the shows end up going on Broadway anyway. And I also am part of a theater company in Chicago. It's a theater called The Ruckus mm-hmm. that me and a few friends from Western Michigan University started up, and now we're well into our first season right now.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so if I
don't... Yeah, so you have plans. You're going somewhere from here.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to try to stay in the U.S. for a while and kind of establish myself, and then eventually, if luck would, you know, be on my side again, I get to either be based somewhere in Malaysia or here, and then just kind of work all around. Before I came to the U.S., I said that the one thing I wanted to remember is that I came from another country, so I have like a whole wealth of experience, and my home is somewhere else, even though I feel like the last 6 years I've been here, this is home. But it's important to remember my roots. And so as an artist, I want to be what I dubbed, it's kind of a high dream of mine, but I want to be a global artist. You know, I want to be able to adapt to any production or anywhere or with anybody I want to work with anywhere in the world. So
I don't think that that's an unreasonable expectation for you.
So far, so good.
Yes,
no. I'm making my way there.
Yeah. And the other thing I find myself thinking is that it doesn't sound like you have to make plans.
You're right.
You know,
if my life keeps going the way it's going,
yes, that you can
I just have to
you
work
can just
hard
wait
for
and
it.
See.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you don't.
Well, the other thing is I have to keep saying yes.
Yes,
because
exactly.
If I don't say yes, then the other door that I want won't be there.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
But that perspective suggests that you know there will be something to say yes to.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think it's the truth. Okay, so now I have seen you in...
Here at the Oslo?
This year, tell me.
Perfume shop.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Because that is so not you.
It's not.
Oh, my God.
It's a facet of me.
That's really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Because that was the very first thing I saw you in.
Right.
Which, you know, speaks volumes about what a wonderful actor you are. Because
thank you.
It's got, I mean, I'm not talking to that guy at all, you know. Talk to me a little bit about that character and that play and what you, I'm sorry, really, that we didn't get to do this before, because then I would have told everybody to run out and see it. Oh. Not only did I love the play, but you were wonderful.
Thank you.
You were wonderful. So talk to me about that experience.
Sure. Well, the part is essentially a 17-year-old messenger boy in 1937 Budapest.
Yeah, right.
And you know, it's kind of very kind of a stock character in a lot of I guess farcical comedies where there's always either like a maid or a messenger boy that feels he's smarter than everybody else, and he's also kind of a commedia character where he's hungry for something.
Yeah, right.
He's hungry for power, mm-hmm. but
he's also something of a, well, for most of it anyway, he's something of a screw up.
He's a simpleton.
Yes, that's the word. Right. I didn't, right. That's right.
Yeah,
right.
And he's, you know, he's a little clumsy, but
yeah, right.
And he's very honest.
Yes, and he's very sweet.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, he's cheeky too.
Yes,
he is. He knows sometimes when he's joking around mm-hmm. or kind of like
he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And it was a lot of fun to play. I mean, such a young, youthful, exuberant guy.
And simple, because you are anything but simple.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I guess.
Yes,
so.
You are. You're not.
I don't know. I think the way I got into it was that everything that happened to Arpad in his life, in the play, is life or death. That's kind of like my approach.
Uh-huh.
Like even little things, like if somebody didn't get like a change or something, if I'm late like 2 seconds, I'm going to get fired or something bad is going to happen, mm-hmm. then I think it just adds to the comedic effect of
Yes.
Where he just takes it way too seriously.
Too seriously, right.
Yeah. Which then, of course, in the play, when he sees the owner of the shop...
When it's really serious,
it's right. just like, oh my God, I don't know what to do, you know? Then everything just explodes.
But he does know what to do.
He does know what to do, yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. And his love for the people in the shop, it's really his family. Because mm-hmm. in the play, he doesn't really talk about his family.
No.
And so the people in the shop and the owner of the shop has become his father and his mentor. And I have no doubt, like, after the play ends, he'll continually work at the shop, mm-hmm. you know, forever, and perhaps even one day take over the shop.
Yes.
So, and he goes out of his way to help people, but at the same time complains about it.
Yeah.
you know?
Yes, well, he's not alone in that.
Yeah. And it's just, it's a really, really fun play to do, and I had such a good time.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful, and you were wonderful. And so you were also in Galileo?
I was, yes.
Yes, talk about that.
The part I played was Ludovico Marsili, who is this rich landowner with a lot of influence, who is kind of a mommy's boy. Mm-hmm. His mommy kind of sends him off to, you know, do this, and do that, and take care of this, take care of that. And he's a very, very kind person and very loyal.
But very conservative.
Very conservative, yes, and but he doesn't believe he's conservative. He feels that he believes what everybody else believes. So it's, I guess, in a way that he's the voice of the church and the voice of
he's traditional.
That's the right word for it. And he's the only guy, the only character in the play that gets to infiltrate the family of Galileo, because he falls in love with Galileo's daughter, and. And then there's a lot at stake for him, because if Galileo, and he gives an ultimatum to Galileo, says if you don't stop whatever you're doing and just follow what the church is saying, not only will I, you know, tell people what you're doing, and, you know, because he's powerful, and not only you lose that, you'll also lose me as a future son-in-law,
right.
And your daughter will be unhappy. And I think that what I've learned in doing the play was that at the end of the day, it's just all about love. It's just his love for Virginia, the daughter, that keeps him going. Because they were engaged in the play for like 8 years or something, and he just couldn't let that go, even though Galileo has been, you know, adamant about his beliefs. So.
But in an odd way, he chooses love of the life he's known, his family.
Yeah.
He's torn between
the two loyalties,
right.
And he ends up choosing what his tradition.
His tradition.
Is, yeah.
Right. And Galileo is not torn.
No.
You know.
It was a difficult choice for him to make, but we all know it was the right thing for him to do. But back then, my gosh, I'm sure it was twice as hard, or maybe three times as hard, than how we saw it in the play. And you're right, he was adamant, and if he didn't do that, then, you know, technology and science...
Yeah, where would we be today?
Yeah.
Where would we be?
We might still think that the Earth is flat, or the Earth is the center of the universe.
So, and again, this is a very different character.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He's a lot older, and...
And more self-assured.
Yes. And a lot more poised... I mean, just in terms of energy, he's a lot more controlled, mm-hmm. I think the character in Galileo I play, he has a lot of people influencing him, as opposed to Arpad in Perfume Shop, where he tries to influence other people, and he influences or decides on his own future, and that's kind of like...
Well, that is such an interesting thing to say, because I would have said it was the other way around, but of course you're perfectly right, yeah. Because I think of the character in Perfume Shop as, I mean, he's completely dependent on them keeping him there.
Yeah.
You know, he can't make them keep him.
Yeah.
But I think you're right that while the other character looks like he's got all the power, he really doesn't.
He doesn't. Yeah.
He really doesn't. And in the end, say his name.
Arpad
does wind up influencing his own life.
In fact, there's a in this cut of the play that we did, there isn't a scene where Arpad goes to Mr. Hammerschmidt and convinces him to hire him as a salesman again, and you know, promotes him to become a full-time salesman. It is
they cut that out.
It wasn't in the original play, but there is other variations of the play. Like in She Loves Me, Arpad has a whole song where he tries to convince Mr. Hammerschmidt to hire him as a salesman. So he does have that influence. In fact, the other cut that we made in the perfume shop that is in the original play is Arpad talks about how he also has two other jobs outside of the perfume shop.
Ah.
He also runs, I can't remember what the other one is, but the other one is he has, he's the superintendent, or the super in the apartment building that he lives
in. Oh, boy, that changes it so much.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, you would know that, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right. And that changes my whole idea of that character.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's somebody who's, because they all are struggling.
Yeah.
You know, they're all, it's a time of war, or
right.
a war, incoming war.
Coming.
There's
right.
a curfew
coming,
going
right.
on.
Right, and there's not
It's
war.
A dangerous world outside, yeah.
That's right. Okay, so now, here you are on the brink, right,
yes.
of this, right? It's
great.
Really, truly. I mean, you could, one can put that off and put that off, but here you are, right? So it's actually very exciting for me to talk to you and to be in the presence of that energy, because most of the people that I talk to are on the other end of this, you know. So is there anything that you want to say about what you think it would be like to live a life, to make a life and a living doing this thing that you love?
I think... even right now, you know, like you said, I'm in the midst of moving the frame of mind from being in an educational setting and having kind of everything supported to basically doing whatever I want and deciding on every single decision I ever make in the future. And I've been kind of psyching myself up to make it be exciting, to allow myself to change or to embrace anything that can and will happen. And I think I just have to be, I think the challenge is to have to be open to it. Because, you know, in the last six years, being in an educational environment, that, you know, there's always somebody who's going to support you or give you advice or...
tell you what to do.
To back you up or tell you what to do, essentially. Yeah, you have a schedule, you know, you have a timetable, you have exams.
Right.
But...
Right.
But the challenge is different, I think, and I'm, to be honest, really, really scared.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, excited. So just like, you know, this thing going on in my head, trying to figure out how to really prepare myself to it. And
do they not help with that?
Who?
The training.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in terms of training, yes. Like, I think I have, like, the skills to do it, to tackle it. If I were to end up in a rehearsal room with a bunch of strangers, I can, you know, hold my own. But in the everyday things, in the waiting in line at 5 a.m. for an audition, you know, it's the tenacity of it that I think...
Yes.
...in a way that I haven't really...
Had to
go through, yeah.
Well, no, the truth is that in your particular case, you didn't have to... I mean, they all came to you. It came to you so much that, that's an interesting challenge that I hadn't thought of. And, of course, everybody talks about, you know, the aspect of rejection.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, which, to be honest, something I haven't really had to deal much with.
No, that's exactly
right.
I mean, when they say to you, why don't you come with me? I mean, that's not exactly...
The rest of you, thank you, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, no, they pick you out of the street. They pick you out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're walking down the hall.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I... So do you think that there are skills to deal with that, or is
I think that
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the other aspect that I was going to say too is learning how to later, you know, when I leave here, learning how to keep myself creatively stimulated. I think that if I somehow learn how to keep my creative juices flowing, then I think I'll always feel fulfilled. Then the rejections won't hit as hard, because I know that, you know, there's something that I am doing in my everyday life that's keeping me inspired. And I think that's the skill set that I think we have here, and especially in the first year training of just, you know, sometimes if you're I remember like the first semester of class here, all we had to do was just sit down and listen. And that's all we had to do for like 2-3 hours sometimes. And just, you know, like sometimes when you stop and listen, things affect you, things you hear, things you see. And that's what I've been kind of like trying to implement every day. Just kind of like every sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I just like take maybe 10 minutes to just kind of be quiet and just listen around.
It's a kind of meditation.
It is. It really is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and then you don't get caught up in the crazy life of, you know, if I was an actor, like rejections and, you know, running over to the job here and job number two and job number three and audition. And
you know, I think you're talking about something that I think is really important, and mostly people don't talk about, and that is that if you're an actor or, you know, if you make your living or your life with an art, people who do that, people who make their living or their life with an art, tend to think of their work as who they are. Mm-hmm. You know, a plumber or an accountant is not necessarily identified with the work. Mm-hmm. So if they get a good job or they don't get a good job, or, you know, if they get fired, they may not want to be fired, but it isn't that they lost the plumbing job or they lost the accounting job. Whereas an actor, a dancer, a singer, painter, quite often identifies with the work so much that if it isn't there, or it isn't the work they want, or it isn't the success that they want, or they didn't get the response that they want, then they can feel less than.
Yeah.
They can feel not there,
even. Yeah.
So I'm not sure you're saying this, but I know that what it made me think was how important it is to have a there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And the one thing I've learned, another thing I've learned, one of many things I've learned, is that, you know, athletes train every day to be good at what they do.
Yeah.
Musicians train every day.
Every day, that's right.
And
They work on their chops.
Yeah, and actors, I think, should do the same, much like any other artist do. You have to train your craft. You have to keep your craft sharp. You have, you know, to keep your mind sharp and your, I don't know, like enunciation sharp, or your body sharp and you're healthy, so you can always... You're always, you know, top form, much like an athlete.
Yes, your instrument.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's tip top. It's well oiled. You know, it's tuned.
Right. And the thing is you're an actor, whether you're working or not.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
And in your case, you're a good actor whether you're working or not. And holding on to that, it seems to me.
Yeah. And yeah, and I was talking to a friend of mine who works in Chicago as a casting director, and she said, the only advice I have for you is that when you go out and audition and people don't hire you, it's not because you're a bad actor. It's just you're just not right for this
one.
That's
right. That's right.
That's all there is to it.
Yes. But now, in order to have that, it seems to me you have to have the other thing I was talking about, which is that you don't lose yourself ever. Mm-hmm. To any audition or any part or any audience or any critic, they don't have the power to take you away from you.
Yeah. But it's hard, right?
I don't know, it's hard.
I don't even know how I'm going to do it. But
well, it's hard. I think it's hard because, well, you know, this is my soapbox, but I think it's hard because as a culture, we don't, I don't know the Malaysian culture, but I know here, we're all about what you did, you know, what you achieved, what you got, what you, you know.
You're only as good as your last play.
Exactly. You're only as good as your last whatever.
Yeah.
Right? That you didn't, you cease to exist when the thing that you have done is done. Right?
Yeah.
Now, this is just nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
But the culture continues to present that as a reality. So you're always working against it.
Yeah. I think it's a struggle with, you know, the idea of instant gratification. You know, you have 30-minute sitcoms.
That's right.
2-minute meals.
Right. Yeah, 60-second sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And so I think that's the challenge. I think the challenge is to find whatever it is that continually reminds you of your own value so that it's not outside you.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking of earlier when I talked about remembering where home is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm full of quotes from my friends today. a friend of mine before I left Malaysia said, and this has been quotes been said over and over again, like, you don't know home until you leave it. Mm-hmm. You know, in a way that applies to everything. Like, you won't know what happiness is till you find sadness. Mm-hmm. You know, you won't know what a successful career is until you've had a lull of 6 months of no work. So it's learning at how to appreciate the little things. And
And what you have when you have it.
Yeah, yeah. And appreciate yourself, really, and be... I guess in the idea of when you don't have work, just appreciate that time off, I guess, and appreciate the time when you will be busy for 6 months straight.
This is the challenge.
Yeah.
This is the challenge. Yes. To come to whatever it is you come to about this.
And be okay with it.
And not be okay with it. Yeah, yeah. And it's very hard because other people won't be doing that.
Yeah.
Other people will be making the mistake of identifying themselves with their role or with the job they did or didn't get, mm-hmm. and they will be judging you mm-hmm. based on what you did and mm-hmm. didn't get, and they will be laying that judgment on you. So it's very hard.
Yeah.
It's very hard, but it's part of the challenge of trying to make your living or your life with an art, because our culture doesn't support artists.
Yeah.
So you have to find a way to support yourself. And I'm not talking about financially here, even.
Right,
you know,
right.
Which it doesn't do either.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, it's true what they say. You know, it's a really hard life to be an artist, regardless of what your medium is. But I think a lot of artists remain in the industry or remain in the craft because they can't imagine doing anything else.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect place to stop this. Thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh.
This was absolutely wonderful.
It's been great. It's one of my favorite interviews.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
It's been fun. It's been fun.
It has been fun.
And it was so much fun that I am hoping to continue to interview Gafé as he continues to try and stay in this career which he has chosen and which we were both saying is really difficult to stay in. And as he was saying, people stay in it because they can't imagine doing anything else. And is that not just simply a way of saying, this is who I am? I do this because this is who I am. And that, of course, is the major theme of this show, discovering who am you? Who is it that you cannot imagine doing other than, being other than? We live in a culture where so many people say work, you know, everybody hates it, but you have to do it. Or that work, it's all about money, but it's not, but, you know, if you don't like it, it's too bad. And then you listen to people who make their living as, or their life, because most artists don't make their living, even while they're making their life of acting or painting or dancing or singing, you know. Well, you listen to that, and you hear that they are who they are. And, you know, the old Popeye, the sailor man, I am what I am. And he was unashamed, unrepentant, whatever it is, he am himself, right? And actors and dancers am what they am. And as you could hear in Gafé, I mean, what's so wonderful about this story, and many others of the ones that I've heard, is that he didn't know. But then it became an option for him. And then he realized that it was not only an option for him, it was him. And so he has embraced it, given up what most people would have thought of as a safer career, engineering, gone against the wishes of a loving family who were anyway able to support him in this choice because he found himself. And there's just, I mean, I just keep saying the same thing over and over again because I really believe that that is perhaps the most important thing you can do. all the happiness and comfort follows from that. And dissatisfaction follows from trying to be something you're not, or being in denial for something you are. So, enough of that, Lynn. Now it's time to thank the intrepid Josh Hackney for doing the thing I can't do, because I am what I am, but I'm not a lot of things. And amongst them, I am not up and running on a lot of the things that it is necessary to have to make this show happen, and Josh is up and running on all of that stuff. So, computer, electronics, recording, web, all that stuff. I trust Josh with my radio career life. So if you have need of any of these qualities, abilities, and skills, then you want Josh Hackney as well. And you can get him by going up on my website. And, of course, you can get me by going up on my website. You can find the book, old podcasts, talk to me about, well, anything you want to talk to me about. And the website is thelynnshow.com, thelynne, don't leave the E out of Lynn, SHOW, thelynnshow.com. And, as always, I hope you heard something you can use in this show. Something you knew, but maybe had forgotten or hadn't thought about in quite this way. Something you didn't know, something that surprised you or got your curiosity up or interested you or, oh, I don't know, something that will bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And boy, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Going with a bang. Life's a song I keep keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got good